From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, it's a give and take, looking at the things we gain and lose. We meet a man giving up his tattoos in hopes of getting a career.
If you really want to change your life, you know, you're going to have to change everything about you.
And in a country hoping for peace, a journalist learns just how complicated a civil war can be.
I guess I had the idea, a lot of people have, that this was just about drugs. And my Colombian colleagues showed me their images and their work, and I began to understand that this is much more complex.
Plus, when money floods into an otherwise poor Native American reservation, and Cubans get to take home the money they earn. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Fue por la curiosidad que yo salí a la calle, se abrió la Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On today's show, stories of give and take. You know, that process where you win a little and lose a little and hopefully try to find some sort of balance. Speaking of which...
My fellow Americans, tonight I'd like to talk with you about immigration.
There was some big news on one of the biggest give and take, stop and go political issues of our time.
Our immigration system is broken. And everybody knows it.
On Thursday evening, President Barack Obama announced that he was taking executive action to make recommended changes to U.S. immigration policy. The big headline, undocumented immigrants who have U.S. citizen children will now be eligible for temporary legal status. The status could shield them from deportation and allow them to work legally. The president laid out the conditions in his speech.
If you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows and get right with the law.
Altogether, the government says the action will provide some benefit to about 5 million of the 11 million undocumented Americans living in the United States.
And to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer.
Pass a bill.
At a viewing party for the speech in Manhattan, around 200 activists, union leaders, and Latino families celebrated the president's announcement.
Oh, estamos desde hace días esperando el anuncio, pero con muchas preguntas.
Monica Morales says her family had been waiting for the announcement for days. She came from Guatemala 7 years ago. Her daughter was born in the U.S.
¿Cómo se sintió cuando usted se sentó?
Now she believes she might qualify for deportation relief.
We are here for the millions who cannot be here.
It does not grant citizenship or the right to stay here permanently or offer the same benefits that citizens receive. Only Congress can do that. All we're saying is we're not going to deport you.
We didn't know what he was going to say, and then we watched it in Spanish.
In Bellevue, Nebraska, 19-year-old Stephanie Zambrano watched the speech alongside her family in their living room.
Even though they say it's a little change, like it's not a big difference, but I think it's a big difference.
Stephanie is a dreamer. She was brought to the U.S. by her parents when she was 3 months old. She's affected by the news as well. The president's executive action on Thursday renews and expands DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the program that gives temporary legal status to dreamers. Receiving DACA in 2012 was a huge change in her life.
Like when people would ask, where are you from, or where do you come from, or where's your family from? I was kind of afraid before to even say anything because I didn't know what was going to happen. It was like a relief knowing that I had some way of staying here.
Thanks to DACA, Stephanie was able to get a scholarship and apply to college at the University of Nebraska. The president's action extends DACA for another 3 years. Stephanie's happy about that, But she's mostly relieved that she doesn't have to worry every day that her mother could be deported.
I think it's going to affect my mom a lot. She's always been having to work hard in buildings and cleaning and stuff, and she's never been able to go higher because of her status.
Just to be clear, the other big news from the president is that the parents of Dreamers are not included in Obama's action. Stephanie's mother, Teresa, also has children who are U.S. citizens, so she will probably qualify for some relief. But she also says she's scared of applying.
Me da miedo. Pienso que también nos puede deportar al terminar su permiso.
She's worried about giving information to the government that could be used to deport her in the future if the political tides change.
Después vamos a tener un problema.
I've seen the heartbreak and anxiety of children whose mothers might be taken away from them just because they didn't have the right papers.
Meanwhile, in New Orleans, Francisco Ortiz was watching the announcement on Thursday and thinking about the fight ahead. He's a community organizer with the Congress of Day Laborers.
It's not inclusive enough.
Some of the president's harshest critics in recent years have been immigrant activists who are furious at the over 2 million deportations that have happened on the president's watch, separating families and deporting non-criminals. Fernando López is one such activist. López sees the executive action as a direct result of the hard work of the undocumented activist movement engaged in grassroots democracy. But he says many of those activists won't benefit from the executive action.
Just for instance, the LGBTQ community, they are the ones that some of the people that have sacrificed the most and pushed the most for this change. And just for the fact that they might not have children, they're not going to be included.
Fernando himself is undocumented and isn't sure if he will qualify for relief.
This is just a step forward, and this is not a complete victory, and we have to fight even harder for those that are going to be left out.
So what will Congress do for those left out now that the president has issued a challenge?
I want to work with both parties to pass a more permanent legislative solution. And the day I sign that bill into law, the actions I take will no longer be necessary.
Now the ball is in Congress's court. There are members that want to see Congress take the lead, like Democrat Luis Gutierrez.
Every opportunity has been given to the Republican majority to act. They control the House. They control the Senate.
So even though he's a Democrat and a strong ally of President Obama, when it came to deportations, he's been one of the biggest thorns in President Obama's side.
Congressional reporter Matt Laszlo has been following this story closely. He interviewed Gutierrez as well as Republican Representative Raul Labrador of Idaho. Labrador is key when it comes to persuading Republicans to pass immigration legislation.
Because he's going to be leading the caucus one way when party leaders seem like they want some sort of comprehensive immigration bill. And I think that's because they want the White House.
Labrador, like many Republicans, feels that Obama's actions are divisive.
I wish he would just listen to what the American people are saying. They're divided on this issue. And he was supposed to be a president who wanted to unify the country. And instead, he's trying to divide the country. And I think that's going to be his legacy.
And as for how Republicans will react immediately?
It's Congress. So constitutionally, they control the power of the purse. There's about 60 or so members that are saying, hey, let's actually shut the government down so the president and the people know that we're fighting and we're standing up for our constitutional mandate.
So President Barack Obama's actions are something, but in context, it's not huge. It's a temporary measure that should decrease the kind of deportations that separate families. Back in Omaha, 19-year-old dreamer Stephanie Zambrano is cautiously optimistic about the future. But she's still waiting for what so many immigrants are waiting for, real, comprehensive immigration reform.
More could have been done, but like Obama said, like if they want him to stop making these little changes, then they need to pass the bill. Because I feel like this is just little steps to what could become like a big change, but I guess it's not going to happen anytime soon right now, and I hope it happens soon.
When Congress will act? Well, that's still anybody's guess. In 2002, Elvira Arellano, a Mexican immigrant in Chicago, was arrested for living in the U.S. without papers. But when her deportation order came in 2006, she refused to turn herself in. Arellano claimed sanctuary in the Adalberto United Methodist Church with her son, Saul, a U.S.-born citizen. She was finally arrested at a demonstration in 2007 and was deported. This March, Arellano dared to cross back into the U.S. again. All the demonstrators with her applied for asylum together, while their loved ones cheered them from the U.S. side, less than a quarter of a mile away. Arellano was allowed into the country while an immigration judge decides her case. She rejoined her older son, Saul, who's now 15, and the pastor from Adalberto, Emma Lozano, in Chicago.
We were deported when I was 8 years old, and then I lived my other 7 years in Mexico, and now we're back.
Friends told me, don't cross. Think about it. Look at your kids. Your baby could suffer because you'll be separated. And they told me this because they love me, because they appreciate me. And I said, no, I'm going to do it so that I can know if I can return to the United States. We're only fighting so we can know what's possible. So I said to the community, don't stop fighting.
Well, I'm like their godmother. I'm the pastor of the church, and they're members of my church since for many, many years. Adalberto, where she was in sanctuary.
We came for my mom because she already got released, and she's here with us. She's going to be in parole. She's going to be here until her case is resolved, and we're going to wait here. And then we're going to go back home, Chicago.
Well, more than anything, I was afraid that they'd throw me out and order me to go to federal prison because I have a previous deportation. So I was very nervous and afraid, of course. But thank God I'm here.
So I was starting to get a little doubtful, but, you know, we just kept, you know, praying, and then we kept pressuring Obama to do what he has to do, because it's not just about Elvira and Saulito. I mean, I love them, but many of people in my church are in the same situation. So it's just a situation. It's a human crisis, and 2 million people deported. Eventually, they were going to come back, because you can't just unjustly deport 2 million people when there's a broken law.
We are giving my message to President Obama that begins here. Your immigration reform, this reform that has given so many false hopes to families, has given them only criminalizations, raids, deportations, and family separations. My message to President Obama is saying that he has power to stop the deportations of these families. These families hope to return home here in the United States.
I've come to vacations in Chicago. I come every vacation, but I think now I'm going to stay for a while. I feel happy and really excited to go back home.
Elvira Arellano has been released into the U.S. on parole. An immigration judge is expected to decide her case within the next year. Coming up on Latino USA.
A lot of the Indians got the rough land, the bad lands, and just so happens to be a lot of minerals in those types of areas today.
What happens when oil shows up on Native American land? Stay with us. No se vayan.
Mis calles, por ni cuenta nueva, que lejos están mis Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Over the last few years, President Raúl Castro has been slowly liberalizing Cuba's socialist economy. The government has started allowing small, private businesses to operate on the island. And now it's been experimenting with turning state enterprises into cooperatives and letting the workers own and run them. For the first time in decades, these enterprises give workers a stake in their success and allow their members to take home the money they earn. Jonathan Wolf has our story.
It's Thursday afternoon at the Bahia Health and Beauty Institute in Havana. The 5 o'clock exercise class is packed. Bahia is a beauty salon that operates out of an old mansion. It used to belong to the Cuban government, but was recently converted into a cooperative. Tania Lourdes Ortiz Fernandez gives facials here. She made around $15 a month when Bahia was run by the government. Now, she makes around $42. Plus, she has a say in running the business.
The other system we had was a little imposing, because before we had to work with the products we had here, and well, everything was secret. For example, an inspector would come and the products that weren't from here, the products that I had to give good service, I had to hide them. I think a lot of people feel the same way as me, that we're happier now than the system we had before.
Cooperative farms have existed in Cuba since the beginning of the revolution. But this is the first time that the Castro government is permitting non-agricultural co-ops to operate. That is, Cuban corporations that are not controlled by the state.
Before, we belonged to the government's parent company.
In Bahia's lobby, President Adriana Cervantes says she's anxious, but welcomes the change.
The parent company told us what we had to do, and we were obliged to do everything they imposed on us. Today, now that we're a cooperative, we have the freedom to make our own rules. We can design everything ourselves.
Nearly 300 co-ops have opened in Cuba during the last year. They're democratically run. The workers vote on a budget and elect a president. Cuba is divesting these state businesses because, basically, it can't afford not to.
The state cannot be responsible for unplugging your toilet or fixing your car or, running the restaurants and cafeterias all over town. And that's what it did until a year ago.
That's Rafael Betancourt, an independent consultant who works with international enterprises and co-ops in Cuba.
So the decision is made, let's stop doing these activities as a state and let's turn them over to their workers. When you decide that, you have two choices. You can sell them. Or if you are still, as Cuba is, pursuing socialism as a model, as an ideal, then you can try to give it to the workers and maintain some modicum of collectivism.
One of the more popular co-ops to use in town is Taxi Rutero. It runs a small fleet of buses that it rents from the government on fixed routes around Havana. The co-op's members are responsible for everything, from training to repairs.
Here I am on 31st Street about to get onto the new bus.
A ride on Taxi Rutero costs 23 cents, compared to the 2 cents for a government bus, which tends to be unreliable. For clients Aniel Nelson and Arely Sanchez, the higher price is worth it.
They're good quality, comfortable. They're great.
This is much better because it's a lot more comfortable, it has air conditioning, it's affordable, and you have a comfortable trip.
My Taxi Rutero driver, Luis León, also likes the setup.
For example, I make what I earn. I'm paid for the effort I put in. Because sometimes, I don't know, there are other jobs out there where you work and work and work, and you never see the fruit of your labor.
There are issues, León says. It's hard to find spare parts for the buses, and the government doesn't provide them. But even Cuba's famous shortages aren't likely to slow down the expansion of the private sector.
Well, in many ways, it's really a sea change.
That's Eric Leenson of Soul Economics, a U.S. enterprise that promotes socially responsible business in Cuba. Over lunch, he predicts that soon, half of Cuba's economy will be in the private sector.
So on the one hand, what has been very secure in the past is no longer so secure. On the other hand, on the upside, I would say for many people, is there's much more possibility of creatively engaging in building their own future. So it's a very brusque and a very fundamental change in the mindset of how Cubans operate as sort of economic beings.
Evidence of this change can be seen in many of Cuba's new cooperatives. Today is Café Bien Misabe's grand reopening, the first day it's operating as a cooperative. And as it happens in Cuba, there's a blackout. Normally, in an average government-run restaurant, employees wouldn't be thrilled about serving customers in the dark. But here at Bien Misabe, they're cooking by candlelight. And head waitress Ludmila Hernandez is assuring her customers that the lights will be back soon.
We're giving the best service we can under these circumstances. Drinks and some dishes that haven't been affected by the lack of electricity.
If it succeeds, this experiment could salvage some of the character of the socialist revolution as Cuba moves forward.
Before, we thought we knew where we were going as a country, as a society. We had this sort of all planned out. History proved that we were totally wrong. We had no idea where we were going.
Consultant Rafael Betancourt.
We were not on a path to socialism or communism or whatever. We were in a particular circumstance that collapsed as an option in the world. And rather than accepting the fact that we all have to be now cutthroat capitalists because that's the only option, we're really seeking a third route, a third path.
This social experiment is very different from the one Betancourt was living 20 or 30 years ago. He says this time it's about building a more democratic society, where Cubans have a greater say in their daily lives, without forgetting their past. For Latino USA, I'm Jonathan Wolf.
And now, dear listeners, a story about tattoos. So, people get tattoos for all kinds of different reasons. For self-expression, for attention, to rebel, or in order to fit in. And even though tattoos are super common today, certain kinds of tattoos still carry a heavier stigma than most, like the ones that make it look like you could have been in a gang. But getting them removed isn't just an easy fix. The process is painful, long, and costly. A program in California, though, gives young people a chance to do this all for free, and those taking them up on it are aiming to change their lives. Emily Wilson has our story.
How's it going? What's going on? Again, I said, don't ask me if I've been sleeping because I don't like lying to you.
It's 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning at Highland Hospital in Oakland. Lawrence Martinez is here for one of his regular visits with Dr. Alice Chen. They wear goggles to protect their eyes from the laser beam.
Enough for me to stop, okay?
Yes.
Martinez is 30. He wears glasses and a ponytail. He's been coming to the hospital once a month for the last 4 years to get the tattoos on his hands and neck removed. Everyone at Project New Start, from technicians to doctors, volunteers their time. Martinez first heard about the program when he was getting treated for alcoholism.
It's looking good.
It is, huh?
Yeah, it really is.
I was talking to one of the counselors, and he was telling me, if you really want to change your life, you know, you're going to have to change everything about you. If you want to pursue goals in life, he told me you can't have tattoos all over your neck and your arms, you know, and your hands. So I said, what the heck?
Martinez decided to get Boss Hog lasered off his fingers, Martinez off his wrist, Loretta, his mom's name, off his neck, and Hardhead off the back of his neck. And that's what he was, he says, a hard-headed drinker, until his family in the Central Valley kicked him out, and he was living in a park.
And I came out here to my sister's, and I drank myself out of her home, and she was just tired of it. And I said to myself, let me go into this six-month program, and let me just show people that I can be sober for 6 months, and then I can sneak a drink here and there.
That's not what happened. Martinez finished rehab and became a counselor himself. He began the drawn-out process of getting his tattoos burned off. It hurts. A lot. The laser breaks up the pigment so it fades over time, and the skin often blisters. So why does he go through this time after time? Because people see him differently.
To be blunt about it, my eyes are pretty open to society today. And it's like, okay, well, you have a Mexican guy here. He's got long hair. Or his head shaved. He's got tattoos all over his body. Gang member. Bad person.
I guess it's like a weight is off.
Adrian Alvarado is the director of Project New Start.
As the tattoo starts to go away, they start to unravel this other sense of self or who they want to become. Even their gait will get lighter.
That's what happened with Martinez. Many people in his family were alcoholics and addicts. His parents didn't send him to school until the third grade. Martinez was embarrassed about wanting to learn. He started drinking at 12, dropped out of high school, and got his tattoos when he was in his early 20s.
And the weight that the tattoos brought, especially the time in my life when I got them, there was a lot of just pain surrounding the tattoos, not physical pain, just, you know, emotional and mental pain. So, you know, I did get them to fit in a sense.
Now everything in Martinez's life is different.
When you do meet new people, their eyes don't go on your tattoos.
Along with working full-time, he takes classes 5 days a week at San Francisco State University, studying clinical psychology and human sexuality. Now he's not ashamed to be seen with his backpack and books. Sitting outside before class, he says he's enjoying his new life.
With all the stress that comes from studying and staying up nights in to study for an exam, it's less stress than it is watching your back on the streets or waking up from a hangover and not knowing what you done last night.
Martinez is a natural student, says Alice Chen. She's one of the doctors who's been working on his tattoos since the start.
I remember one time he came in for a treatment and he had a book with him and was saying, what are you reading? And he was reading Kant and Nietzsche. And I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, that is really intense stuff. Personally, I can only get through one page of it at a time.
Looking ahead, Martinez plans to get his BA, then his PhD. He wants to work with people who are on the street, the way he once was. Not having tattoos makes that goal easier.
The tattoos don't make me anymore. It really doesn't. I don't need tattoos to be smart. On a street, you need tattoos to be quote-unquote hard, be quote-unquote bad. Well, I don't need tattoos to put my damn head in a book.
He says now people judge him by what's in his head rather than what's on his skin. For Latino USA, I'm Emily Wilson in Oakland, California.
Have tattoos affected the way you're perceived? Do you feel like they've actually worked better in your life? Let us know on Twitter, where we're at Latino USA, or check us out on Facebook and leave a comment about your tattoos. It used to be that the roads of a North Dakota reservation were just about empty in a place with a skyrocketing unemployment rate. But now, oil tankers rumble down those same roads near Mandaree and Newtown, North Dakota, which is home to one of the nation's biggest oil booms. Both towns are on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, home to the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people. But another tribal town, Twin Buttes, is just east of the oil field, which makes it a lot quieter with a lot less traffic. Twin Buttes resident Corey Spotted Bear and friends recently constructed a traditional earth lodge to keep native traditions alive during the oil boom. Spotted Bear talked to reporter Todd Melby about the oil on the reservation, and for one thing, he's pleased to see that people who never had much money suddenly do.
At our pinnacle, at our peak, was when we lived in these round homes here, and it was Black Elk that said in his book, Black Elk Speaks,
He said, when we moved, when the government forcefully relocated us into these gray square boxes we live in today, these modern homes, he said, that's when our people begin to get sick.
That's going to change after we cut it, isn't it? Okay. Yeah, that's good.
I always say, you could ask a great horned owl to be a red-tailed hawk. You could ask him to try to live like that, and he'll try it. And geez, you don't see good during the day. And they're both birds, and they're both big birds of prey, but they do things a little bit differently. And so you asked one group of people to live like another group of people, and things didn't just pan out. But when we lived in these round homes, they say things were really good.
Okay, that's good for your top.
Yep.
Just west of us here, there's a big oil boom going on. The oil line stops just west of the Twin Buttes community. And here we are, just on the other side of that line. We're putting the symbol back on the land where we're flourishing again. We're chipping away in that direction. Zeb, take those two ladders down. That looks good. That's good, guys. And then Marty, that one looks good too, where you're at. It's even with the other side, so... People ask me, what's your view, what's your take on oil? And when they allotted our land, when they first had the Dawes Allotment Act, when they had during the reservation period, and they start giving individual allotments out, and after each individual allottee got their allotment of the three affiliated tribes, they opened up the additional land, and they called it Indian Surplus Land Act, and they opened it up to white settlement. A lot of the Indians got the rough land, the bad lands, and the just so happens to be a lot of minerals in those types of areas today. And what they opened up to Indian Surplus Land Act was the top agricultural land. We'll just say it, the whites, the non-Indians got that land. And so today we have minerals and people get mineral checks and mineral leases. You know, is it right or wrong, or do I feel bad about that? To see an old grandma or a family that I've always known to not have much monetarily, to have them have a nice pickup truck or to have the means to go to town or go to a Twins game, I'm okay with that part of it, you know.
What'd you say about this? Notch it shallower?
Now, I'm also happy that the oil line stops west of our community. No, it's quiet still. And, you know, people, they acknowledge that when they come here, like especially people from Newtown. I think you live right in town there. Newtown's a busy place now. You know, that's our tribal agency. And so people that come over here, different ones helped with the Earth Lodge, you know, for the powwow. They get up in the morning and you can hear some horses in that field, or you'll hear a cow calling for its calf, or you'll hear birds in the trees. And people say, I miss that.
If you want to see what the oil boom looks like, check out our PBS TV show, America by the Numbers, where we went to North Dakota ourselves to examine the economic impact the oil boom is having on the native people. Visit americabythenumbers.org. Coming up on Latino USA...
Colombia is a country with a notorious record for the assassination of journalists, and many colleagues there have lost their lives.
A photojournalist and his journey through the Colombian Civil War. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair. Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights. Information available at ajws.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now let's talk about a give and take that could end the world's oldest civil war. Since 2012, the Colombian government had been negotiating a peace deal with the FARC, the country's largest guerrilla group. But Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos called off the talks after the FARC captured a general from the Colombian army. The government says they'll only start the talks again when the FARC releases the general. The stakes are high for Colombians. The peace talks could put an end to a war that's killed more than 200,000 people and displaced, get this, more than 4 million Colombians. It's the largest humanitarian crisis in the Western Hemisphere. But for a lot of Americans, Colombia is a forgotten war.
I didn't realize how severe the conflict is. I had no idea of the scale of it. And I guess I had the idea a lot of people had that this was just about drugs.
That's photojournalist Stephen Ferry, author of the book Violentology, A Manual of the Colombian Conflict. Ferry went to Colombia for the first time in 1995. After a decade working as an international photojournalist, he was invited to teach a workshop at the Fundación Nuevo Periodismo Iberoamericano, a journalism school founded by Gabriel García Márquez.
My Colombian colleagues showed me their images and their work, and I began to understand that this is much more complex than I realized.
That's because many Americans only think of one name when they hear about Colombia.
Pablo Escobar and his bombings and all were really the last time that Colombia was on the front pages of the press around the world, and that's the image that stuck.
Escobar was killed in the 90s, but the war raged on throughout the 2000s. Stephen Ferry returned to Colombia to cover the conflict for outlets like the New York Times and National Geographic. During that time, the U.S. spent about $6 billion in Colombia's fight against drugs.
This fixation on the drug question is really a reflection of the United States' fixation on counter-narcotics. Clearly, drugs are a factor in the conflict. They're an enormous source of revenue for these armed groups. But there's much more involved.
The conflict in Colombia is complex, but it can be described as a war between left-wing guerrillas, like the FARC, and Colombian security forces backed by the U.S. Right-wing militias, called paramilitaries, also fought the guerrillas, sometimes hand-in-hand with the Colombian army. The paramilitaries officially demobilized in 2006, but they left behind powerful criminal gangs. Now, the guerrillas and the gangs fight the state for control of the country's land, its resources, and the drug trade.
One has to go very slowly and carefully, and oftentimes going to a zone that's under control of a guerrilla group or paramilitary group, you have to find a way to send a message through somebody you can trust who can explain to that commander that you want to come into this zone and you want to be able to talk to him or her. And they're soldiers. A lot of things happen between the lines, and so it's not always clear where the front lines are, for instance. And much of the most important abuses occur in the terms of, like, massacres or selective assassinations rather than on a battlefield.
As a journalist, these killings can target the people that you work with.
Taxi drivers, somebody who took you across the river in a canoe, all these things can really cause a person, you know, can cost them their life, in fact, if you don't work correctly.
And it can cost the lives of your fellow journalists.
Colombia is a country with a notorious record for the assassination of journalists, and many colleagues there have lost their lives doing their work.
The Committee to Protect Journalists says 45 journalists have been killed in Colombia in the last 12 years.
But it's important to remember that as a foreign journalist, I have a little bit more leeway of movement than my Colombian colleagues, because they really run very serious risks. And by and large, I think they do an excellent job. They're incredible investigative journalists in Colombia.
Stephen Ferry's book pays a tribute to Colombian journalism. And he says that despite the lack of international coverage, the oldest conflict in the world is far from over for many Colombians.
In many ways, the conflict has calmed down, but it's still going strong. And a tremendous number of people in the country are under death threat at this moment.
We've put together an audio slideshow where Stephen Ferry talks about some of the most stunning photographs in his book, Violentology, A Manual of the Colombian Conflict. Visit our website, latinousa.org, and check it out. It's estimated that there are about 200,000 immigrants living and working in the state of Massachusetts who are not authorized to be there. That's according to the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. And according to conventional wisdom, all immigrants are here to do is work. But they're not just working. They're paying taxes. In fact, many undocumented immigrants file their tax returns every single year. And nonprofits around the state of Massachusetts are helping them do so. Sarah Reynolds has our story.
February, March, and April are busy months for the Community Economic Development Center in New Bedford. It's tax season. Luis Farfan stops by with his wife and kids to file his, like he does every year. Farfan always comes prepared, says CEDC Executive Director Corinne Williams. For the past 11 years, this community organization has participated in a federal program that helps low-income people file their taxes. It offers free tax service to families making less than $52,000 a year. Williams says she gets all kinds of people coming in who fit the bill.
And many of them are immigrants who are here without papers, like Farfan.
We find this every year, that families are filing on a consistent basis, and they are paying their taxes, contributing into the economy. And I think it is a widespread myth to say that immigrants don't pay their taxes.
Everyone who works in the U.S., no matter what their immigration status, is required to pay taxes. To file, you need a number. If a person isn't eligible for a Social Security number, and even many authorized immigrants aren't, they might need what's called an Individual Taxpayer Identification Number, or an ITIN. Unauthorized immigrants fall under this category, too. This number is only for filing taxes. It doesn't provide work authorization or access to public benefits. And the IRS says it doesn't track the immigration status of ITIN users, so even the government doesn't know how many ITIN filers are unauthorized workers. Williams asks if Farfan has been saving his returns from previous years. They're all archived at home, he tells her. He came here from Guatemala more than a decade ago, but he's been filing his taxes for several years with his taxpayer ID number. Sometimes he has to pay, and sometimes he gets a refund. She asks him for his bank account number so the refund can be directly deposited. Another tax incentive for low-income people is the child tax credit. This year, Farfan is receiving the credit for his three kids, all U.S. citizens born here. He also sees paying his taxes as an investment in their future. Filing with an ITIN allows him to create a history of their presence here, with the hope that if a comprehensive immigration reform happens, he might have an opportunity to get papers to work and stay in the U.S. I have to give my kids all the opportunity here that I can, he says. The number of unauthorized immigrants living in the country is difficult to count accurately, as many of them live in the shadows of our public systems. But according to data from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. paid more than $1 billion in personal income tax in 2010.
I think people do want to do the right thing.
That's Corinne Williams, executive director of the CEDC.
It's a way for immigrants to also develop a track record of living in the United States and to say that they've been being responsible and paying their taxes.
For the unauthorized workers who file their taxes, it's still an investment with no guarantee. And not everyone thinks it's a good idea. Bristol County's Sheriff Thomas Hodgson says it's hypocritical to encourage people who are here without papers to pay their taxes when they're here without documentation in the first place.
Can't have both ways. Can't be double speaking, because that's why even the people who are coming here illegally get confused.
Hodgson has held the sheriff's seat in Bristol County since 1997.
He also oversees one of three Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facilities in the state.
If I were coming to you illegally, you're saying, well, they don't really care because if I go there and I'm paying taxes, they know I'm illegal, then they must think it's okay. And on and on and on it goes.
Even with the uncertainty, for some, it still seems worth it. If a person who's here without documentation has an opportunity to adjust their status or to avoid deportation in the future, an immigration judge could ask, have you been paying your taxes? Skylar Pisha is the legal director at Catholic Social Services of Fall River. He says having paid taxes can prove good moral character and in some instances could change the outcome of a case. And it's also a matter of pride.
There's an assumption that because people broke the law by coming here that they have no respect for the laws of this country, which is often not the case. I think it's usually not the case. They think of themselves as law-abiding people.
Pisha says these immigrants often come from countries where there are few opportunities to get ahead, so they're willing to do whatever it takes.
It's the honest sort of opportunities that are lacking. So if people want to be gang members, be drug dealers, those kind of careers are always available in their home countries, but people come here because they want to make an honest living.
For unauthorized immigrants who get paid on payroll instead of under the table, they will likely never see their withholdings because they often work with invalid Social Security numbers. Their Social Security contributions are put in the same pool as the rest of us who pay in. This pool is then used to pay out benefits to U.S. citizens and others who are eligible, but not to pay back these unauthorized workers. The Social Security Administration says the financial contribution from this workforce helps keep the Social Security program solvent. In New Bedford, Corinne Williams says the Community Economic Development Center filed more than 1,500 tax returns through their federal tax assistance program this year. And she estimates that more than 25% of them were filed by unauthorized workers.
I think they're looking forward to becoming part of the American fabric in that sense of doing what every other American does, you know, before April 15th.
It's an investment without a certain payoff, but some unauthorized immigrants hope filing tax returns can prove their willingness to contribute to a new country they'd like to call home. For Latino USA, I'm Sarah Reynolds.
This story is part of a series produced for WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station. For more, check out our website, latinousa.org. And to end our show now, some words of wisdom about giving and taking. There is something really special about the relationship that a mentor and a mentee establish. So for today's Sabiduría, we hear from Heather Kristen and Iris Torres. They met in the after-school program, Girls Right Now, and they've been friends ever since. They start us off with a little of their poetry and then tell us what they've given and taken from each other.
I wish someone had told me it's okay to fall in love with whoever you want and that gender doesn't matter when someone makes you feel elated and important, even if that person happens to be your best friend. But that's okay. I wish someone had told me that religion should protect you and not make you feel afraid of what you don't quite understand. And I wish someone had told me that youth, innocence, and freedom should never be abused.
Brown was her name, bright were her wings. Lights brought black dreams to be seen and heard on a screen that the world thought was everyone. Don't they know it just crushed men and left women slick with oil on their bodies, barefoot and shining? The flame burns on and more generations ooze. They dance and sing, not knowing where to trod. Their lipsticks smudge on each other. They are mixed as one. Don't trade yourself for the glow. Let it go. Get deep. Words will be rewarded. Toil and soil can change the world.
Heather, when you were homeless on the streets of New York City, what were your dreams back then?
Probably just to get through a day. Oftentimes, my mother would come and say, okay, this person, you know, is going to let us sleep in their apartment. And we would stay with them. And then like 2 days later, she'd be like, okay, they don't want us here anymore. We have to go find somewhere else. My dreams were just focused on finding another book to read. And I began writing in my diary at that point and just living day to day in the present moment and just trying to stay together. What are your dreams now?
I want to write for a purpose. I feel like I was put on this planet for a purpose, whether it be to write or to teach or to document lives. I feel like I'm here for a reason. And my dreams are to find out what that reason is, whether it takes me 5 years, whether it takes me 10 years, 20 years. I want to look back on my life and feel like I accomplished my dreams. And my dreams change day to day. And I feel like that's what dreams are supposed to do. You're not on a straight path. And that's what makes life so exciting and so exhilarating, is it's ever changing and new obstacles and new opportunities arise. And that makes life a lot more fast paced and a lot more enjoyable. When I learned about your childhood and what you've been through, and I look at how successful you are today with your family and your writing, it honestly reinforces the notion that it doesn't matter where you come from, it matters how you finish. So you really gave me a sense of hope. So thank you.
Oh, that's so sweet. It's heartbreaking.
I feel like you took my resilience from me. Like, you kind of grew tougher skin when you realized what I've been through, and then you realized you can accomplish anything. Doesn't matter where you come from.
You gave me an incredible amount of courage to continue writing, because I was writing a young adult book, and I thought, oh, I don't really know if I can continue on with this. This is such a long process. And you kept saying you can do it. And you actually gave me a necklace, which I'm wearing today, with the elephant, and because I'm writing a book about India. And even though I didn't know much about India, you encouraged me to keep following that path and to keep reading books on India. And I traveled there, and just to keep exploring.
Mentor Heather Kristen and mentee Iris Torres, they met at an after-school writing program called Girls Write Now. And that's it for this week, my dear listeners. And we've gotten a lot of love from you. We hope that today you've taken away some wisdom. For more, please visit latinousa.org and be sure to check out our PBS and World Channel television series, America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa. It's at americabythenumbers.org. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Shu and Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on PBS, on America by the Numbers. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security. At carnegie.org. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Ooh, it's cold in here.
Ay, qué frío que hace en este cuarto.
It's cold.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.